This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Mass Bay Guides. Mass Bay Guides is our family-run charter fishing fleet that's based out of Scituate, Massachusetts. We've been providing anglers with the ultimate fishing adventure for over 20 years. Whether you're looking to put together a multi-boat corporate fishing trip, a trip for your family, or you're an avid angler looking to catch a giant bluefin tuna, our crew will do anything it takes to make sure you and your friends and your family have a great day on the water. To book a trip with us, please visit the Mass Bay Guides website, www.massbayguides.com. You can search prices, trip information, and get the latest reports and links to our social media pages there. You can also find us directly on Facebook and Instagram and just search Mass Bay Guides. This episode is also brought to you by Deep. New England born and bred, Deep is inspired by the fit of the skate and surf retail world, anchored in the technical aspects of the outdoor and offshore fishing apparel market. Deep designs clothes that bring comfort in the elements and also at the bar and restaurant. If you go visit shopdeep.com and use the promo code Friday30, you can take advantage of the ongoing Black Friday sale now through the holidays. And it'll get you 30% off your next order. Our newest sponsor to the podcast is LT Marine Products. Since 2011, LT Marine has been designing and developing innovative, unique, and high-quality American-made sport fishing equipment. Taylor and I have known the crew at LT since they started. Chris is a great guy. We've been using every single piece of equipment that he's made over the last several years. His rod holders are extremely heavy duty and high quality. He has the machining equipment to be able to put your boat name on the face plates, and do other custom work as well, which is pretty cool. And recently, over the last couple of years, we've worked with him to develop some new products that have actually been very popular amongst the Northeast Northeast fishermen, specifically offshore and tuna fishermen. So two of those products have been his swim hook for if you're harvesting a big giant tuna, you want to take care of that fish as best you can prior to bringing him on board. And part of that process is after the fight, swimming the fish, you know, for a certain amount of time, kind of depending on the health of the fish and how the fight went, but usually ends up being around an hour to get all the lactic acid out of the muscles and give a better product at the end of the day when we sell our fish. So we helped him design an affordable swim hook to be able to tow the fish behind the boat at a low speed and accomplish that goal. So, that was a pretty cool product that we collaborated on. And another one is the new LT Marine release hook. We've been doing a lot of release fishing for giants over the last couple of years with the way that the quota has been open and closed. So we've really had a need for a way to properly revive these fish and get them back into good health upon release. So if you go on the LT Marine website, you can see the release hook there. You can also go on our Instagram, Facebook and see how we have it rigged, but it's a tool that we've implemented into our process aboard our boats and it makes releasing fish a lot safer for the crew, a lot better for the fish, and it's a really high quality product. We used it all season, never had a problem, never broke it. So definitely check out that new release hook from LT. Or if you want to see any of Chris's products, you can visit ltmarineproducts.com or check him out on Facebook and Instagram. Our next sponsor is Black Oak LED. Black Oak LED manufactures high-quality LED lighting at a reasonable price for many different industries, including hunting, fishing, military, and tactical. If you're looking to upgrade the cockpit lights, spotlights, undergunnel lights, underwater lights on your boat, make sure you check out Black Oak LED at www.blackoakled.com or at Black Oak LED on Instagram. Taylor and I just purchased the 360 Marine LED light bar kit with the 30-inch light bar for the new Line Shy. It's the name of our new center console that will be running starting next season. So that kit includes a 30-inch light bar, like I said, and then four flood combos that we're going to kind of spread out evenly across the T-top to illuminate the deck and help us get bait in low light conditions. All that for around $1,000. It's a great price point, awesome product, and they have a lifetime warranty. If you need lights and want to go with Black Oak, please make sure you use our promo code GIANTBLUEFIN. That's all one word, capital G, for 20% off your order. Our guest on today's episode of the podcast is Captain Jamie Bruce of Bruce Brothers Fishing Charters, based out of Prince Edward Island, Canada. We've been close friends and basically family members with Jamie, Troy, and the rest of the Bruces for more than a decade now. Over the last 11 years, we've been fortunate enough to enjoy many great days, both on and off the water together. We cover a lot in this conversation. Jamie explains the history of fishing, specifically for giant bluefin tuna, within four generations of the Bruce family. I think it's now fifth with Ben. I'll have to fact check that with him, but within four generations and his experience within fishing in the family. And then we tell a lot of fish stories, but we focus a lot on what we've seen and learned and what we've seen change over the last 10 years of tuna fishing. Both up north in Canada, on the waters of Nova Scotia, Gulf of St. Lawrence, and here in Massachusetts. We talk about hooking fish, fighting fish, landing and releasing fish, drag pressure, the resurgence of bluefin tuna or giant bluefin tuna population in general. We even talk about charter client pressure and how we deal with it on a day-to-day basis. So we cover it all really in this one. We think you guys will like this episode. It was definitely a great way to end a successful first season with this podcast. And without further ado, please welcome Captain Jamie Bruce. Welcome to the Seabros Fishing Podcast.
There we go.
Now you can there see me. Hold on one second.
you can leave it where it is. Just bring it. Yeah, turn it. There you go.
Yep.
Much better.
Much better.
We were just talking about topics.
Topics?
Yeah.
We don't. So how you've both been? Pretty good?
Now the fishing's over, not as good.
Not as good.
Yeah.
Snowstorms sucked.
Yeah, you guys got a lot more snow than we did. We have barely anything here right now. We got a lot of rain coming here Monday into Tuesday, and going to looks like a green Christmas.
I got a solid foot at my house in about 8 hours.
Wow.
Yeah, it dumped. Yep.
I wish you could send that this way. We got a bunch of snowmobiles sitting here we can't even use.
Oh, it sucks.
We should like crack a beer. It's a little
dude,
early.
Dude, it's 9 o'clock. I mean, that early. Doesn't stop.
I mean, he could do the hair on the dog real quick.
I was going to recommend we do it on a Saturday night, but I didn't think that was a good idea.
Yeah. I don't know how productive we would have been.
Yeah, I'm actually glad this is in the morning because we probably would have all brought out the rum and had a interesting conversation or no conversation.
Dude,
we could throw Blair into the equation. It would have been a real good
we hand fed Blair to a giant. Dude, we could do a whole one of these just on drunken stories from
just
up
on
there.
Blair.
or just on Blair.
That's one thing I'm gonna have to be careful of. You know, we all love to talk about Blair, but he's going to listen to the podcast, guaranteed. Yep. So, it is.
Well, it's good to see your face. I know we've talked a bunch, but this whole year has just been, like, fucking weird.
Crazy. Absolutely crazy. Yeah. Sucks. It does really suck. It sucks. Yeah.
So, what's the latest and greatest COVID-wise up there? What's just, like, the general, like, sense for everyone?
Well, we've kind of gone back into some more restrictions here. We had some community spread, which was our very first here about a month ago, and they put some restrictions back in place for a couple of weeks, which had just lifted some of them this week on, I think it was Friday, they lifted a few of the restrictions. So we're back up to allowing 10 in a household, but they want it to be the same 10 that you normally mingle with and stuff like that. But in-room dining is allowed again with restrictions, of course, at the restaurants. But it's actually in PEI, we've been pretty lucky. We only have 7 active cases right now.
Yeah.
So Ontario, Quebec, out west, they're in a mess right now. So. And actually, I was looking at your guys' numbers. You guys are on the climb again.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been kind of all over the place.
They did the same thing with us. They just went back to whatever it is.
Yeah, the city of Boston.
3, level 1.
Yeah. City of Boston restricted things a little bit more just because of the density and cases.
Yeah.
The cases there. And then the state rolled back a little bit, but not quite as much as the city.
Yeah.
I mean, nothing for us anyways, nothing has really changed over the last couple of weeks.
The thing up here that gets everybody is, you know, you're not allowed X amount of people in a rink. You're only allowed 2 observers per player. But then in the meantime, you go to a big department store like Walmart or Home Depot and you're shoulder to shoulder. Nobody's following any of the directions on the floors. So
wild,
you know,
isn't
it? Yeah. It's like the big department stores. It don't matter to them.
Yeah.
So, you know, and even in our faith services, I heard them talking about, they're only allowing 50 people in a church, in a big church. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's nuts. Huh. Not a lot of consistency across the board, that's for sure.
Yeah. But the vaccine was just rolled out there this week with very limited doses, but we'll see how that goes.
Yeah. Claire just got the first, because she's at the hospital, so she just got the first round of it.
Okay.
A couple days ago, so
she didn't grow any horns or anything.
No horns, you know.
Yeah, that's
good. It didn't make her hornier either. So that's
Jesus.
So there's no side effects there, in case you're wondering.
Too much info.
No benefits yet.
Yeah,
no benefits. Yeah,
right on. She's probably cursing me upstairs right now. So yeah, thanks for doing this. We've been waiting to. We were waiting to hopefully do it in person in September, October, but obviously that didn't happen. I know we'll talk about the kind of impacts to the charter fishery in a little bit, but
yeah,
just to kind of kick things off for the listeners, I know Taylor and I know every single detail about Bruce Brothers fishing, you know, the whole Bruce family history of fishing for the most part. I mean, I've known you for the better. More than a decade now.
11 years.
Yeah, 11 years.
Yep.
But can you just explain the history of fishing in your family, describe the family business, anything and everything, how you kind of progress through the season from, you know, lobstering to, you know, charter fishing. I know you're not herring fishing per se anymore, but just kind of how that all works up on the island. And then kind of like on a scale from 1 to 10, 1 being super basic, 10 being crazy detail, like how I tell stories and bore people.
Yeah.
Do like a 5 if you could.
Okay. Yeah, sure. No problem. Well, the fishery in our family goes back a long time. On my father's side, I'm 5th generation. On my mother's side, actually, my mother's mother, or my grandmother, is from Newfoundland. So we got some Newfie in us by, and that goes back a quarter few more generations. Fishing here in Prince Edward Island for us has been primarily because of lobster fishing. That's been the mainstay, and it still is the bread and butter of the fishing in Prince Edward Island. Back in the day, the bluefin tuna fishery started with my father and his brother-in-laws of dad's, and that was in the 70s, late 60s, early 70s, and that's when Ken Frazier and some of the legends of the fishery were also active. And their group at that time was called North Lake Tuna Charters. And they had an office and a secretary who looked after all the bookings. It was on a first-come, first-served basis with phone calls. And it just went down the pecking order of how the captains were lined up, so everybody got their equal share. That continued until probably the mid-80s, and that's when the tuna made a brief disappearance from the waters here in the Gulf. that stayed that way until probably 1995. I think the first fish returned was caught here off of North Lake. It was by my Uncle Cork Hughes. And then I guess, you know, the fishery, the way the lobster fishery works here, it's a May and June fishery. There's a transition then. We normally, guys would take the boats home and clean them up. The wooden boats, of course, you'd paint them up, paint the copper and change the anodes. And the fiberglass boats, well, it's wash and wax. We still currently do that before we do our charter fishery. And so, you know, take the boats home, get them ready and go charter fishing. Nowadays, there's a lot of guys that concentrate in other things, including ourselves. We do some bait fishery in the summer, which is mackerel. And the idea behind that is to get our lobster bait for the following spring. So this year, Troy, Ben, and myself went hard at the mackerel fishery. And like currently right now, I've got over 20,000 pounds at the cold storage in Surrey. And that's for my next spring's lobster bait.
Jesus.
You still have the trailer. You still have the trailer at the lake too.
We sold the trailer, the reefer trailer that we used to freeze all our bait in. Yeah. It became way more expensive than what they offer in Surrey. Surrey's only a penny a pound per month. Wow. So it's pretty reasonable. We were up over 3 cents a month just on the reefer. Yeah. Great accessibility, but Surrey's only 5 minutes away, as you know, so it's not that far.
Yeah.
So we sold it to a fisherman in Cape Breton Island who had a hard time getting access to a cold storage facility. So
worked out for everybody.
Worked out for everybody. So, yeah, so we went at the mackerel fishery, and that's what a lot of guys do here now is to get their bait. Bait has been a problem. There's getting less of it, and that's due to a lot of various factors of overfishing, water temp, you know, being probably the two main culprits. And then the charter fishery here opens in around the end of July, and it goes through all of August and into September and October, as you're aware. The commercial fleet this year for bluefin tuna started around August 1st, and it was a cracker right out of the box. It was excellent. The early fishery was fantastic. A lot of smaller fish that were around, but they were top water, and it was very exciting.
What do you call a small fish?
300 pounders, probably.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's a little different.
There was 200 pounders also. Yeah. 200 to 400 pounders is probably the average weight in that early season now. And then as the water cools and the bait migrates, pattern changes, the bigger fish follow the bait. There's a direct link between herring and large tuna.
Yeah.
100% confident of that.
Yeah.
Where you find herring, you're going to find large tuna, no question. And the topwater mackerel, we call them tinkers. They're only 3 to 5 inches long. That's what the topwater bluefin are chasing is the upper water column bait. And that's why we're seeing the smaller fish now. We have a lot of topwater column bait, and then, of course, the small fish are following them. And that changed here in the last few years. We never used to see small bluefin in that range in any volume of numbers, that 2 to 4 to 500 pound fish. We never used to see that many. Now we're seeing a lot of them, and it's due to the bait, the small bait fish, mackerel, and water temp. Our water temps have gone way up.
Same with us.
We're consistently seeing 70 to 73, 74 surface temp for at least a month and a half now.
Wow.
And we never used to crack 70 for any more than a week or, you know, a week and a half at the very most here, probably 5 years ago. So it's only in the last number of years we're starting to see that warm water. And that has pushed the herring north a little further. And it has the big fish have chased the herring. So
how is the clarity? Like, how's the clarity been? Has it been improving over the last, you know, couple seasons here? It's been, last year it was like gin clear almost the entire
like canyon,
season.
Almost like canyon blue water looking water a few of the weeks.
Yeah, no, we haven't seen a whole big change there. We're still getting the green water. Wind, of course, will stir the bottom up. We're so shallow here.
Yeah.
It don't take much wind to make the bottom rile up and become murky. So that part hasn't changed.
Yeah.
Like when we're tuna fishing, a deep water for us is 150. Most times we're inside at 120 feet or 100 feet. And this year I know guys were fishing in 80 feet of water, which is only a mile and a half off the shore.
Yeah.
So, and you guys have experienced that with me also. We're just outside the harbor and dropping a line and you couldn't believe it. So that part hasn't changed. We're still fishing close.
That's great.
But, you know, the charter fishery here for our family, and I think back in the day there was probably seven guys in my dad's family that were active in the charter fishery all at once. All of Walter, my Uncle Walter, he was the last to retire at her dad's family. He was 75. Last year was his last year. This year he went with his son Scott just as a deckhand, and no doubt he was still the boss on the boat. Yeah, but yeah.
He was the deckhand. The boss.
That's right, yeah. In my family right now, between first cousins and my brother Troy and Kent and, of course, nephews and my son Ben, I think there's nine of us active and every one of us have a so tuna cool. license. Yeah. So, you know, it's a big thing with our family. And Dad and them back in the day in the 70s, they were called the Bruce Boys. And then, of course, that's kind of where Troy and I came up with the name of the Bruce Brothers. So,
yeah,
I think that was doing a large part with you guys and your father, especially back in 2010.
I remember
when you guys first came up here.
I remember that conversation, breakfast before we left after commercial kind of the
breakfast
derby
at Bluefin.
There. Yeah,
at the breakfast at the Bluefin. Yeah, which is no longer.
I know, that's so sad.
Yeah,
I know. Yeah, very sad. But she just opened a new restaurant.
That's good.
Called Straight Goods. So
yeah,
back perfect. In business. Yeah,
that's awesome. One thing too, you know, kind of like you guys that we share in common as far as the families being involved in the charter business is, you know, our wives and, you know, your kids and
everybody's involved.
Everyone's
involved. They have to be involved. It's a team sport.
Yeah.
There's team no way to do it without them.
Whether it's bookings, absolutely. Whether it's food, you know, it's, you know, that's kind of what makes it special, I think, is everyone is a part of it.
Everyone pulls their weight. Bonnie, especially, she does a lot of food prep and seafood chowders, and you know, making up some stuff.
Seafood chowder.
Yeah, Brian had to see. Brian and Greg got special treatment that time. They were up here with the seafood fettuccine.
Oh God.
Yeah, but we do that. We do. You know, she gets pulled pork sandwiches ready in the crock pot, so you know, chilies and stuff like that. So yeah, no, without Bonnie and the kids being, they're very instrumental in how this whole deal runs. And the same with Troy, with Claudia. And the same with any charter captain up here. Their wives and their family are a huge part of it. Everybody knows everybody, and it's a small community, as you know. So everybody's involved.
That's what makes it a special place is you go there. And it's, you know, you get that similar vibe during the season here, you know, coming into Scituate Harbor and, you know, everyone's involved and stuff. But there's something about there where it's the whole island, or at least that section of the island, everyone is involved with it in some way, shape or form, you know. So it's like all consuming when you're up there, which is what makes it different from a lot of places.
I think the major difference with that is when you're up there, everyone respects the fishery and everybody knows what the fishery is for them, or at least has some kind of knowledge of it when they're walking around the docks or they're nearby or whatever, or they're in the restaurants. You know, there's pictures of tunas all over the place and you know, lobster, and it's just different from here, where we could be backed up to the docks and there's a tuna on deck and we have 75% of the people that walk by don't even know that it's a tuna, or they ask, you know, what is that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and PEI, there's no what is that? It's that, you know.
Yeah,
they don't even have to ask.
The whole neighborhood goes down and sees the offload.
Yeah, they ask how much did that fish dress?
Yeah, that's right.
What that fish dress out at? You know, yeah, it's different.
What's the core weight on that one? Some little four year old kid next to you. You know,
that's the major difference. Yeah. It's like
everybody grew up with it here, right?
Right.
So we're so seasonal. The fishery is such a huge part of Prince Edward Island in general. It's one of the main industries, that and farming. And then tourism is right there with fishing as number two, three. So when we combine the tourism aspect of the charter fishery with fishing,
right,
it's a huge deal. So everybody knows exactly, you know, like our harbor master, Sheila, she'll know exactly when a fish is coming in. And people just congregate around the wharf. And like you said, what's the fish weigh and how much is that going to dress? Like,
right,
you don't even have to ask them. You're right. Everybody knows it's a part of our culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's awesome.
Slightly jealous.
Majorly jealous. That's why we go up there every year. So you mentioned quote unquote fish left in the 80s kind of leads us into our next topic here. And you kind of already talked about it a little bit, but maybe a little more detail. And I think we can all start to share some stories because we've all fished together for the last 10 years. But, you know, go back to 2008, 9, you know, kind of the quote unquote hand feed beginning or re-beginning, I guess, because you've probably seen that stuff before in earlier years from time to time. But can you kind of talk us through how it's changed from, you know, the hand feed madness, which again still happens all the way till, you know, now, how it's changed, how you guys have evolved, how you've adapted, you know, maybe talk about how the locations, you know, change throughout the season on the island, how you've changed your tackle over the last 10 years, like what you've learned about what you can do with tackle.
These are a lot of topics.
It's a lot of topics, but if you just kind of can look back at the last 10 years and what's changed overall and how you've got better.
I think a big thing has changed is the herring. We used to go into herring fishing. Like I said, you asked what we do, you know, from the progression from lobster and what was after lobster before we started tuna fishing, and herring was a big deal. So I used to be a herring boat, one of the herring boats at North Lake, and Craig actually and Blair fished with me on the herring boat. And before that, I went out on a summer fishery on a smaller version. My brother-in-law, Mark, Bonnie's brother, came fishing with me. And we used to mark a lot of fish. And then all of a sudden, we start to see them coming to the surface. You know, as you're shaking a gill net out, scales fly, herring fly, and they're falling in the water. And the tuna were coming up, and they were scooping them up. So I think in probably 8, 9, and 10, more so 8 and 9, we saw it was consistent. You hook on, you weren't even hooked on to the first pickup buoy on a herring net, and the tuna were right there waiting for you. And it was crazy. It was just madness.
Yeah.
And that continued for probably 3 to 4 years. Like it was nonstop. And for what reason, we're not sure.
And when you say nonstop, paint that picture of nonstop.
We'd leave the harbor and we'd go and hook onto a buoy. Within 5 minutes, the tuna were sitting there waiting for us, and they'd be at the surface swimming around. And as soon as you chuck one piece of bait overboard, they come up and they grab it. You chuck five pieces of bait over, five tuna come up and they grab it. I remember, I'll describe it this way. We had a group from Texas. They're up for the four guys. They're up for the very first time. And they said, "How far are we going?" I said, 5 minutes. "No way." I said, 5 minutes. I said, "You better," they're stand-up guys. They love stand-up. And I said, "You better get your belt on." And they're like, "Well, no, we gotta hook up first." I said, "No, you're gonna hook up as soon as we get there." And they didn't believe me. And I'm like, "No, I'm serious." I said, "Put your belt on. We'll get you measured up with the rod to make sure you're balanced and everything's good." "You serious?" I said, "I'm dead serious." So we stopped. I said, "You ready?" He said, "Really?" I said, "Give me a bait, Blair." We put a bait on, we threw it in the water, it was gone.
No chum, no nothing.
Nothing.
One dead herring with a hook in it.
Yep. Let it go.
I've seen, I'm laughing because it's hilarious, but we have seen it with our own eyes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Like the first time, Brian had been up there, I think 2 years in a row, or at least 1 year in a row. My first time up there, you know, it felt fake what you guys were talking about. And I remember you were like, "We're going to go out there and we're going to do these," I forget what you call them, like power circles or like baits, you know, chumming circles or whatever it was.
Chumming circles.
You chumming circles, and you're like,
"That old tactic."
"Well, yeah, I'm going to go to Southwest Corner and do some chumming circles next August." Anyway, so basically what you described was you were acting like you were a herring boat. So you'd go out to the spot, you'd attempt to mark a few fish. You really didn't even have to because they were around. And you would just kind of put the boat in up on like a, I don't know, medium plane, I guess, and just do like a, I don't know how big the circle was, maybe 300-400 yards.
Yeah, something not
like
very that. Big.
Not very big yep. circle. And you just start chumming herring over, like, you know, throw a piece, wait a second, throw a piece, wait a second. We did a full circle. We put it in neutral and there was like 30 fish on the screen. And all of a sudden, they were literally eating the paint off the side of the boat. In the first, like, 10 minutes I've been up there on this boat. Yeah. I couldn't believe it.
That's, It was crazy, crazy,
crazy. Yeah. And that was just one of, you know, you've probably had what, hundreds of days like this.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Them the years especially, like 2011, 2010, 2011, and 12 was like that pretty much every day. It was just, you could do nothing wrong. You didn't have to get smart with the fish. You didn't have to change leaders. You didn't have to do it. We were hooking a herring through its eyes on the buoy gaff, holding the gaff over the side, dangling the tail of the herring in the water. They come up and take it off the gaff.
And how big are these fish?
At that time?
Yeah.
A small fish was 500 pounds. We had grinders doing that. We had grinders doing it. It was crazy. And one thing we noticed too during the hand feeding, you learned a lot about the fish, like a tremendous amount about the fish. The smaller fish, the 5 to 6 to 700 pounders, were aggressive, quick. We created a diversion. The same Texas crew. At that time, we were allowed 4 fish a day.
Releases.
And 4 releases.
Yep.
So they were getting 500 and 600 pounds. Ah, we don't want these small fish anymore. So Troy was with me that particular day. We threw a pile of herring, like as far as our arms could throw them, away from the boat. Because the sounder was lit up, the fish finder. Like it was just deep from surface to bottom right near. And I remember what the National Geographic diver said one time. He was down. We were hauling herring nests. This is before we went out to chartering. He said, all the bigger fish are just lurking down below, catching what falls through or escapes the smaller fish that are being aggressive on the top. Huh. And he said, and they're just catching what falls through. He said, because they're not active. Like they're just big and lazy, right? They're big fish.
Yep.
So we created a diversion. We threw all the herring as far as we could throw them, and we put down a line. Boom, grander. It was amazing.
That's
so
unreal.
You know, and that was at the, I'm not going to say the peak, but that was at the peak of the hand feeding.
Yeah.
No question.
Right.
We still get it. Absolutely. There's times and locations that we can pretty much predict based on the time of year, where the herring is, how the fish are going to be active and things like that. Sometimes you got to sail a little bit farther. You've been there, Brian, and Taylor, you've been there also on one of your other trips. But this summer, Ben was out mackerel fishing there in late August, in the mornings at sunup. And in the evenings, that's the way mackerel is. You got to be there for sunup and you got to be there for sundown. And that's when they bite the best. He hand fed tuna 4 days in a row.
Yeah.
Just not even a tuna hook on board the boat. Just hand feeding tuna. He's mackerel fishing with the big crank reels, 40 hooks on a line, and tuna all around him. They spooked the mackerel. Him and Darcy started throwing mackerel over and they're coming up and just having a field day.
Wow.
So it cool. still happens. It's a little harder to predict, but it still happens. And still all kinds of tuna. All kinds.
Is there like a recipe? Are there like 4 or 5 things that if they all combine that you go out giddy in the morning going, all right, there's a really good chance we're going to hand feed? Or, you know, you're heading to a spot and you're like, all right, you know, this charter has no idea, but like all the stars are aligning to make a hand feed happen. Like, what do you see?
Herring.
And can you make it happen? That's another good question, I guess.
Pretty good chance. Calm weather, not real rough, but, 15 to 20 knot wind. A little bit of wind is better than no wind, unless it's aquarium day. That's another story. A little bit of wind, really nice to have some herring. Like, that's a game changer right there. If you have some herring and you have a small gill net, just a single blank net on an anchor, and you, as soon as you lift that net, you'll know right off the bat. If you've got herring in your net, and you've got on the backside of the tides after the moon, that's key. And you've got, there's generally tuna in the area. So if you got herring and you've got a little bit of chop, a little bit of wind, there's a good chance that you're going to have a hand feed session. No question.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of fun, too, when you just put out a kite and you just use a little mackerel lure and you put a mackerel on and they come up and grab it. So you can play with them for a little while.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think it has to do with like the fish coming back year after year and getting used to it, or do you think it can happen really anywhere?
Well, see, for us, I can't relate to anywhere else in the world, but here in the Gulf and the Northumberland Strait, I think no question they're like a salmon or a river herring. They get used to it. Having said that, I know some areas in the northern part of the Gulf here this summer that done some hand feeding, and these are not even tuna fishermen. They were just out playing around, and there was fish there feeding off them. So we've done a lot of tagging studies, and we've had a lot of fish return to the same areas. We just had a fish that was caught down South Carolina that was tagged here 3 years ago. So these fish are moving a lot. You guys just had a fish that was tagged not too far from where you guys fish and was caught over in Spain. So,
right.
You know, they move. I think we've had some clients from the UK that have been here back in 11 and 12. They're hand feeding fish now on their shores. So there's fish showing up everywhere. And you know what? I think a lot of they're hungry.
Right. Yeah.
There's not a lot of feed. We're seeing a change in the heron population, especially here. Now, you guys have had a rebound in the heron population.
Absolutely.
So that's great.
Yeah,
big time. And you took some measures here a number of years ago and closed it down, and now you're seeing the benefits of that. Our mackerel fishery here, contrary to reports of science, I think our mackerel fishery here is fairly healthy. We're seeing a small recruitment class, a lot of it, actually. And so that's good for the future. But I think with the amount of tuna that are around, it's to do with the water temp especially, and then the food. You know, they're searching for food, and they're just plain simply hungry.
One thing I'll never, ever forget that you told me, or someone told you, then you told me, is the secret to tuna fishing is in your kitchen.
The secret to tuna fishing is, number one, is fish where the fish are.
Yeah.
And then I'll pull a page out of your father's book, make sure your hook's in the water.
Yeah.
And number three is everybody's got it in their kitchen.
Yeah.
We'll leave it at that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's they're starting to see hand feeding down here too. The guys off New York and Rhode Island saw it in November, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Chunking
it. It happens. It's so rare, you know, and you would think with the amount of fish. And we don't even really know how many fish are near us, you know, compared to, you know, the groups of them up there. But you would think it would happen more, you know, with the amount of bait getting caught every morning on sabiki rigs and herring and stuff. You would think you would hear more stories, but it just, I mean, there's 200 boats out there some mornings and everybody's catching bait.
That's the difference.
Right.
You just, you got so much activity on the water. They're not getting comfortable.
Right. And they're not curious, they're scared.
They're a little more skittish.
Right.
Yeah. So we don't have the effort here like you guys have down there. We could have 200 boats on the water in Atlantic Canada. That's from the South Shore of Nova Scotia to Gaspé, Quebec. But you guys have
200
boats
on a Saturday.
Delwagon. Yeah, like it's crazy.
It is.
We have zero recreational component here, so that's a big deal.
Huh.
Yeah, it's a huge difference, the pressure. Is a lot less. Also, the proximity too. I mean, I know we have bluefin relatively close to shore, as do at times like the guys in Carolina and stuff. You know, all the way down the East Coast, really. But I feel like you guys have them closer to shore for a longer period of time throughout the season, so you're able to get on them in those conditions that the fleet might not go here because it's the bite's too far away and. Mm-hmm. I feel like there's a lot more eyes on when they're on those herring on those inshore waters. So you're seeing that a lot more, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just the close proximity of our shelf to the island here, especially on the North Shore. There's areas here this year and the last number of years. There's two areas you can go to at any given day. There's going to be fish there. And you learn these areas just from being on the water every day. And of course, the commercial guys go there also. So. And that's the nice thing of being a small group for the most part. Everybody has a network with the communication ease with the iPhones and whatnot. Nobody uses the handsets anymore. With the iPhones and the text messaging and stuff, you can be on the fish in 20 minutes and know there's fish there. Mm-hmm. So it's a great network to have. And of course, like you said, they're on the shore, they're closer, and works really well.
So going back to skittish fish, slower days, you know, it's tuna fishing at the end of the day. Well, it's really fishing at the end of the day, but tuna fishing in particular. How do you deal with charter pressure? We all feel it. Especially you guys, a lot of your charter fishing is from destination clients too. flying there from a long ways away.
And you can really only target one fish.
Correct.
That's the big. That's the major difference between there and a lot of other places.
So what's your recipe for talking yourself off the ledge during a slow trip?
Well, yeah, you are correct. It's destination fishing, and if they're coming here to fish, they're coming for bluefin tuna.
Right.
Yep. So yeah, there is pressure, and we all feel it. We've all been there, and you guys, you know, got a great business going. You feel it every day, also. But for us, it's hard to handle sometimes. No question, you can feel it, and especially if the guys around you take off and they see the boats leaving, and the crew starts looking at you and say, "Where are they going? Where are they going?" You know, there's sometimes you just got to go with your gut. I'm a firm believer in the history of your location and how comfortable you are and what your knowledge is. Rely on your knowledge base a lot. And just reassure them that give it time, guys. There's a tide coming up, for example, at 3:00. Let's just sit through the tide and keep our hooks in the water. And you can run around a lot. And it's no good to run around a lot either, because you're definitely not fishing then. But there is times, don't get me wrong, there is times that you got to go on the hunt. We'll troll in that case. We'll troll offshore and troll the contour line that we call it, which is the 120 fathom or 120 line off North Lake, and it goes right down the shore. So we'll go on the hunt, but we have our hooks in the water. We'll troll. And a lot of times you just watch for the birds, and birds are great fishermen, and have a good set of spyglasses on your boat, and you'll find fish a lot of times. But the pressure is it's fishing, like you said, Brian. And at the end of the day, you're not going to get fish every day, and that any true angler that's been out fishing knows that can happen. And ultimately, you know that's not your hope. You hope that you get fish every day, and most times we do, pretty good that way. But there is the odd day that you don't get fish, and you feel bad, of course. But you come back the next morning ready to roll, and usually very successful, and everybody goes home happy. Like I say to the customers, said these fish with an eye the size of a tennis ball or bigger than a tennis, don't get big being stupid. So they're smart. They can become line shy, as you guys have seen with me. We've done everything there with one of your groups, the boys from, what's their boat name, the Persistence? Or?
Yeah, yep. Yeah. The McKims.
McKims, yeah. Yeah. And we've done everything there one day for an hour and a half, hand feeding tuna, and no way would they take anything with a hook in it. It was amazing.
That is amazing.
You know, they were coming up, and every dead bait we throw over, they take, but as soon as you throw over something with a hook, they just shy off it. Huh. So it happens. There's sometimes there's things, and no matter what you do, you're not going to hook up. And then there's days you can do nothing wrong. It's still fishing, makes you humble.
I like those days.
Yeah, that's right. They're a quick day and a short day. And everybody goes home.
I like when the fish make it easy.
I like eating my lunch at the dock.
Yeah.
And then they all look at you and say, "Holy shit, these guys know what they're doing. We're done by dinner time." Yeah. You're like,
it's awesome. So, yeah. What are some of the tricks and stuff that you guys do? I mean, I'm sure they're very similar to some of our tricks, but like, is there like a go-to that seems to like your last resort to try to hook one of these finicky fish that are you're marking, but you're having trouble hooking?
Not really. I'm not going to give any secrets away either, of course, but
come on now. I got to dig a little bit.
Yeah. But, green water, keep that in mind. It's pretty murky. So you've got decent visibility for 20 feet. A lot of times they won't come above that 25 foot. So that's when things get tricky. So you got to try and bury your hook, and you try live baits, dead baits, of course. I've stuck pieces of styrofoam cup in the bellies of heron, trying to make them float down a little slower because of the weight of the hook and the weight of the line. That's worked. It doesn't always work, of course. Brian, we've done stick baits. That has worked. Other times it has not worked.
Let me take you through one. The last trip, our last commercial fish I got with you. We fished all morning, literally all morning on the nets, tide change, marked a few fish. No one really did anything all day. We live mackerel, stick herrings, stick macs, flutter macs, like, you know, dead baits, live baits, one, you know, light leader, heavy leader, kite, no bites. You know, Mark, and I'm looking at Taylor when I say this too, like, you know the days when we'd mark like three on the screen all day, probably the same ones, and they wouldn't bite?
Yeah.
Like, that's how it was all morning.
Okay.
Tried everything. Went offshore, did a few drifts, waited for the tide change, came back in on the net. Jamie's like, we're going to try something different. We come on, we marked one or two. He throws the rest of the pan of mackerel, takes one decent looking one, basically smashes it on the gunwale and buries the hook in it, so it looks like absolute trash and out of his hand immediately. That's what they wanted. He wanted rotten garbage bait. That's what he wanted.
Interesting.
Yeah. We went outside and we circled and we came back in and said, we'll try this again. And that's when it worked.
Yeah.
Out of my hands. Yeah.
And you waited for the pressure. There was a few boats working that net, doing drifts over that net, our net, I believe.
Yeah,
and then we came back in and did that,
mm-hmm.
and got caught in two nets after we hooked up.
So you got to improvise.
Yeah.
Like sometimes you just got to leave. Yeah. Sometimes you got to leave.
Sometimes you just got to leave, and the rumble of the boat taking off, and then you come back. Sometimes you just got to leave. They get used to you, and they figure you out.
You know, something hilarious on the rumble of the boat. How many times have you been anchored next to somebody on the bank or whatever, and the guy next to you leaves and you get a bite? Or you leave and the guy right next to you gets a bite?
Yeah.
I'll tell you what's the best. Everybody's working the area. Everybody's
and you
working
pull in.
And you pull in, and you're there for 10 seconds, and then boom, and they're like, motherfuckers. And, you know, it's crazy how often that happens.
Yeah,
it really happens a lot. And it just doesn't happen to me. It happens to anybody. And a random boat will pull into the center of the boats. Everybody else is sitting there looking like an idiot. And he pulls in and he sails away with the rod bent.
Right.
This one here is going to sound really stupid. One of the tricks, take your lines out of the water. Take everything out of the water and just chump.
Yep.
Just chump. They get used to nothing spooking them. You're not working lines. We done that one day with a client from Europe, and he thought we had horns on our heads. he did not like it, and he wanted to work the line. We wouldn't let him work the line. He was not happy, and we were like, just give it 15 to 20 minutes, you know, so we just jump, and the fish get into you can see them on the fish farm. They make the circle, they come back, and they mark them, and they're just grabbing every piece, makes a circle, and you mark them. So then, in the same sequence of throwing your chum, you don't throw just a piece of chum. You throw it with your hook. Boom.
Yeah.
It's gone.
Yeah.
But when you got everything all riled up and you're throwing three heron, you're throwing a single heron, you're throwing 10 heron, you're throwing a hooked heron or mackerel, don't matter. It's just not the same sometimes. And sometimes they'll get into the frenzy and they'll take it. And but a single fish is the hardest fish to hook. So that's when you really got to
definitely agree with that.
Yeah.
Single fish, I feel like you get your chance right away. You get your chance
right
one, one time right away, and if it doesn't happen, it's probably not going to happen.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. And I've dropped the anchor before and left a single fish on the screen. And again, they look at you and say, what the hell are you doing? But you just can't hook them. We've all been in that situation. You've tried everything. You pulled every card out of the deck, and you just got to go for that sail and come back to it. And then, boom, you'll hook up. And they're looking at you and say, how come they didn't do that earlier? The fish gets comfortable. Sometimes you just got to change it up a little bit and come back. And then they feel that a feeding frenzy coming on again. And then you can hook them as soon as you pull back in. Hmm. So there's no explanation. Like we always tell the clients, the fish are very similar, but yet they're different. And you don't know how they're going to act.
Hmm. That's awesome.
What do you see as far as marking? Like, how do you? We have our observations when we're on the bank and stuff of like how fish are reacting to your lines and things like that. What are you seeing as far as like movement on the fish finder from the fish that you go, all right, you know, that's a hot fish or that guy's just passing by? Like, what do you see?
Up and down,
vertical.
You mark fish and they're in the bottom half of the water column. Like for us, I'll say, you know, shallow water again. We're in 100 feet of water and they're marking down at 75. If they're going to react to your chum line or to your baits, they're going to shoot up.
Yep.
And then you got an interested fish. But if they're just marking just a normal hook fish mark at 75 feet, let's say, and they just stay there, they're not interested yet. You can tell. You get the big W, we'll call it. They're coming up and down. Well, you've got a good chance, no question.
Yeah.
And I think that's similar everywhere.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we think the same thing. Just we're fishing a little deeper water for most of our season, you know. Not much, but a little bit deeper.
Yeah, yeah. Like, we've done a trolling squid bears. We've trolled squid bears, and you mark a fish at 75 feet, and then it's got a big, long tail off the back of it. You better look at your squid bear because he's coming for it.
Right,
yeah.
And it's happened a lot of times. But if you just mark a fish and it's still down there and there's no activity or little dots behind the mark, you're just marking a fish most times. So, of course, you're going to make the big wide circle and try and get them enticed and keen on it, but it doesn't always happen that way.
What have you seen for, like, clarity? How far do you think they can actually see? You know, are you marking fish? And these are just questions I'm bringing up. I know kind of what we think, but I'm just curious of what you think. You know, how far can they see vertically, underwater, horizontally, maybe? Like, what's your thoughts on all that?
Vertically, 100 feet, no question in my mind. Yeah. I think it's that they can see that easily. Again, it depends on the day and how, or a previous storm and how long it's settled down afterwards.
Yep.
I'll go back to the National Nat Geo diver. He said once you get below that 20, 25 feet, he said it's just an aquarium, and he said they can see everything, no matter where they are. Yeah, and we've actually saw a video of that. That same diver, and actually a couple other boys too that were local fishermen. One of them is an actual underwater welder. He's a diver, and he does this as a living. So he had the proper gear. He went down in the same area where the herring nets usually are, and that's 65 to 100 feet of water. And they basically just floated in the bottom 10 feet, holding herring in their hand, and the tuna come right up to them, and they just let it go, and they eat it right in front of his hand. So, and there we couldn't see them on the video, but then all of a sudden they come out of the shadows. The same deal, Taylor, as you were testing the underwater dredge that time.
Right.
They come out of the shadows, and then all of a sudden they were there. So their vision is a lot better than...
Which is amazing to think about.
It's amazing, yeah. Like, I think a lot of times we give them too much credit, but at the same time, their eyes are so big, we don't actually know, but I think their vision is really, really good.
They probably have some, like, set distance that's programmed in them too. Like, you look at their colors and how they feed and how they camouflage.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's probably something in their head that's like, all right, I know I can't get any closer than this before I make my approach too.
Well, you see all the shark videos of, like, sharks looking at divers and stuff underwater. Like, you can barely see a shadow at that certain distance.
Yeah.
It's almost like they know that if they stay outside that range, they can attack.
That's right. Yeah. And that's something we don't understand about them probably and we never will. But there's no question they have something in their mechanism in their brain that will trigger it and not trigger it. And it all relates to they don't get big being stupid. So, yeah.
Sometimes they're really stupid. I think they're just really hungry. I think they're really hungry sometimes. And they'll just, you know.
Yeah.
It's like when you're starving, you'll eat anything.
Yeah, you get aquarium day that was, I don't know if we had that since for that amount and length of time. Like, we'd done that solid. It was crazy that
with not a wave.
Yeah.
Nothing.
You want to explain aquarium day to everybody? We're not going to explain it.
Was that 2011? I'm forgetting. I think it was 2011.
So 2010, OG and I came up. That's when we fished for a few days with you and Troy and had a blast.
It was my first year up, I think, right?
Your first year was 2011. Right. We, my father and the rest of the group, Corey, Naz, they came up and they fished the Tuna Cup with you guys in 2011.
They did.
And then Taylor, myself, Frank Pitten, Tom, Ed Lavelle.
Yep.
Ed Lavelle came up right for the banquet night of the tournament. And I remember sitting down with Blair, and that's when Blair was like, yeah, we just do chum circles. And Taylor looks at me like, what?
I didn't want to believe you guys.
Yeah.
You know, I remember sitting down like this. I'm like, so is there like a really good chance we're going to hook one tomorrow? And Blair's like, there's 100% chance.
they're still a little reserved. Like, there's never a guarantee.
No,
it's still
I know.
Fishing. Like, they obviously know
they're like us, right, too. Right. You can't get everyone too hyped.
And I think that's how you were. You were very, you played it way down. Because I think you, you know, you obviously had some pressure bringing us out, but you played it way down and you humbled us thinking that it wasn't going to be, and you didn't even know it was going to be that epic that day. Really?
Well, that aquarium day, we, like I said, we haven't seen that since, to that level. We've had some great hand feed sessions. No, don't get me wrong. But to that level, that day, and the clarity, and I think Brian and you, get Taylor, you guys got some great shots from the roof, and you know the famous picture of Blair holding his hand, Dave, yeah, kind of like scaling where the fish was. Right. They're just coming in droves from underneath the boat, and you take anything you gave them. So the eyes on you guys and the crew of excitement, like a kid at Christmas morning, was unbelievable. And that's the best part about our job. It's so satisfying when you see the excitement level and the satisfaction. Yeah. And then the hype is real, right, at that moment.
Right. It's, yeah, so real.
And you don't even have to hook one just to see them doing what they're doing.
You have no idea how often our emails say, so when's the best time to hand feed? They don't even ask about to hook a fish. When's the best time to hand feed?
Yeah.
We get that all the time. And days like Aquarium Day have done that. Like, we just want to comfort the hand feed. That's all they want to do.
Yeah.
Because it's just another level. It's totally different.
That said, though, there is something about drifting along and the rod goes off. You know, or just like a blind, like 800 pounder.
I like both. I like both extremes.
You know what? Troy and I have had this conversation different times after many days of hand feeding. We're like, can we just go fishing?
Yeah.
Right. And I like, yeah, it'd be nice just to set up on the drift with a kite bait, a long trackety and a short bait, and, you know, get a double. And then our hearts jump out of our chests.
Right.
And the excitement level, and it's just chaos. It's the best part of a hookup, and the boat's doing a 180 turn, and everybody's roaring at everybody, grab that line, grab that line. That, to me, is probably my best part of tuna fishing, is that type of hookup. Because I get the adrenaline rush then also.
Right.
And you're working your ass off trying to make sure everything goes right.
Right.
And then you got beads of sweat running down the side of your forehead, and the crew looks at you, you're really into this. I said, this is awesome. This is the best part.
Yeah.
You know, but when you get the hand feed day after day, and for us it's like, okay, are you ready to hook one now?
Yeah,
you
know? I know.
And
I
there's no surprise.
Yeah, it levels your excitement, unfortunately.
It does. It does, yeah. So there's nothing better than an old-fashioned hookup when it catch everybody's, you know, maybe you got your head into your phone, or some guys are snoozing in the chair, and then the rod starts to go. And you know, that's still the best. For me, that's still the best. Yeah, I love it. And it don't get old.
It never gets old. Never gets
that
old.
That being said, I've heard your voice, and and even new hand feeding days, your voice changes. I don't know if you know that. You get to be that kid on Christmas morning.
That's one of the best. That's one of the best.
In your voice, and you've seen it probably 1,000 times now.
Yeah, I know it doesn't get old. Like we done it there. I don't think I done any hand. I didn't spend any amount of time tuna fishing this year because of COVID, as you guys know. But last year we done a little bit of tuna fishing, of course, with the charters being open, and I think though, one of the best times hand feeding last year is we were mackerel fishing, and Ben and I were mackerel fishing, and then I had my line disappear. Freaking tuna took my mackerel line, and then Ben said, "Got to be more than one here." So we started hand feeding. They were coming up, and we were like, "Oh, look at that!" You know, it don't get old,
right?
So awesome. All right. I paused it for a second, but we're back in action. No worries, man. It happens. We've had it happen a couple times with trying to do it on FaceTime, but
let's dive into some more topics.
I have, so we're already in the hand feed versus like traditional tuna fishing mode. I feel like it's time to tell a couple like crazy fish stories. So I labeled this question, I can't believe we still have this fish on. Can you tell us a couple of those? Because that pretty much happens every single day I fish with you.
A lot of that has, and that was something you guys got introduced to, was fishing the nets.
Yeah.
That was a game changer. Like, you guys learned a lot at that time, and how to just how to relax, dip your rod in the water, walk the bow, come back around, put it underneath the net. we've had so many of them stories, I don't even know which one to tell, but it basically goes like this. You're on your net, you're anchored up, and the fish takes it, and guess where he wants to go? Right underneath the boat for the anchor mooring. So we've get into quite a few big masses before, but basically don't lock him up. If you know, try and make him believe he's not hooked, for lack of a better word, and just take the pressure off him. He can walk the bow. I've passed rods down the opposite side of the boat, underneath nets. We've get into nets after being on the move, and you just relax and pull up the anchor buoy and unravel the rod 5 or 6 or 7 times if you have to, and then shove the drag back up, and still there, and you keep on
trucking. You just explained that in the most calm tone of voice I've ever heard in my life, because it is not that way all the time.
It's not, but like
you said, you just have to relax.
You got to work through it one step at a time.
You got to think about it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had a guy pull up to me one time, and we were on the net, and it was dark. It was early in the morning, and I don't think I had my set on, to be honest with you. I didn't have the VHF on. And he come up, and I was like, is he hooked up? Is he hooked up? And he was hooked up, and he was already on internet. And he was kind of freaking out, and I said, whoa, just relax. You might have been with me, Brian. I think you might have been. Yeah. Might have been when you were there, just hung on after your group left or something. He backed up. I said, pass me your rod. And he goes, you're going to do what?
Oh, yeah. I remember this day.
I said,
pass me your rod.
Oh, I can't do that. Don't lose my rod. I said, just pass me your rod. I said, it's all fine. It's good. So he didn't understand what the hell was going on here. And right. So he backed up, or he kind of pulled up on the quarter, and he passed the rod. So we walked the rod up. We went underneath our net. I think it was wrapped around 2 or 3 times. We unraveled it. We walked back to stern, and I passed him the rod. I said, shove up your drag. Shoved up the drag, and the rod went, phew, swung around. He goes, I can't believe that just happened. And I said, yep, good luck. And he got the fish. I think it was near 800 pounds. So I remember the day he got the fish. But that's the way it works, and that comes from experience, of course, but it comes from realizing, and this is one of your other topics you want to talk about, what you can do with the fish and what your tackle will handle, and you get to know your tackle and know how a fish responds in that and what to do, and most times it works out, no question.
Yeah, it's a miracle sometimes that it works out, because where they fish, like when you're saying the nets and, you know, you're fishing it every day and you're so used to it. But when you're saying the nets for the listeners, it's like trying to fish in a mooring field in a harbor at times. You know, everyone's setting on such a small piece of bottom when the herring are there that you're fishing in and amongst, I don't know, 50, hundreds of nets.
How close are the boats, too? How close are the boats and all that? go through all that.
Yeah, I mean, like. They're like, I guess I can explain it because I've been the, you know, kind of the recipient of it, as from a customer standpoint, bringing groups of people up. There's times where we're all stern to stern with 6 to 8 boats,
and 20, we're 20 feet from each
20
other.
Feet from each other, and the fish are still breaking the surface in between us with nets all around us. So like that's kind of the density of the area that we're talking about. It's a small area, but it's dense with gear, it's dense with fishermen, it's dense with fish when they're there and they're on the herring.
Yeah.
So when you hook up, you know, if you're hanging on your net, you're basically using your net like an anchor, except your anchor line is the net itself. So it's, if it's full of bait from the boat all the way down to the anchor, is just like a fence of shiny, scaly herring or mackerel, whatever it's loaded up with. But it's like that all around you. So you hook up, you know, you're trying to see which way the fish is going, if it's in the chum, if it's under the net, if it's over the net, or if it's getting in another guy's net. There's been days with you, I think we've, you know, like, there's certain etiquette, like any other fishery. There's certain things you do to, you know, make sure you're not breaking guys' gear off, you know, that's not yours and whatever else. But we've had days where every single bite we've had net, got caught in a net.
Yeah.
We've got every single one of them. And it's all just because of relaxing, being used to it, and it's no different than hooking a striped bass at the dock and getting caught underneath the dock and just following the line angle and relaxing, backing the drag off. You know, if you're doing that, you can get away with a lot.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, and again, that's just like you said, it's getting used to it, knowing what you can and cannot do. Like, I'll give you an example. It might have been the night, early morning, we went out for Ben's World Record Fish in 2014. We went out for sunup, and there were some herring boats out there, and there was a guy out there at that time. He's a commercial guy, and he doesn't do charters or anything. I said, how's things going? He said, I lost 7 fish so far at the nets. I'm like, what?
7?
Yeah.
I'm like, oh my.
And I said, oh my God. I said, that's not good. And I looked at the boys. I said, that's what we don't want to do. We don't want to get into that mess because, again, with the etiquette thing, you don't want to, that's the last thing we want to do is cut off a guy's net. I've been a herring fisherman. That's the last thing I want to do is cut a guy's net off because you feel like crap. And then you got a fish. If you break the line, you got a fish swim with a line on it. We don't want to do that. That's not why we're in it. But it goes back to, again, you learn how to handle the situation. And I'd say 9.9 times out of 10, you can get out of it. The best hookup in around nets is when you got other charter boats around you because we're all there for the same reason. That's the easiest. Let's put a dozen boats in a half mile square, charter boats all hanging on nets, which we have done. And there'll be three guys in that ball of boats fighting fish, and we'll all come out of it perfect.
Yeah.
Because you're working together and you're used to it. It's, again, like you experience with it and what you can and cannot do. Now, don't get me wrong. When I was a commercial guy pre-2010, I was scared shitless. Scared to lose a fish, scared to do something I wasn't comfortable with, like shoving the drag, having my drag set at 45 pounds on strike. Like, I'd never do that. We'd fight a fish at 20, 25 pounds. And then you're there 10 hours later and you're still fighting the fish at 20, 25 pounds. We don't do that anymore because you know what you can and cannot do and push the limits. I think with regards to tuna fisheries, charter fishing has taught us so much. It's the best thing that we could ever done to understand a bluefin tuna.
Yeah.
It's amazing what you learn.
Mm-hmm.
It really is.
Same thing here. Since, you know, quotas and COVID and all that, we've been doing a lot of catch and release. You know, we've had a lot of big fish around, and just the time and the being fortunate enough to bend the rod on, you know, a few, you learn so much. It's like anything. The more you do it, the more you're going to get comfortable with it. And if a good season's 5 versus 55, you're going to be a lot more comfortable when the fishing's good.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
There's that humble perk coming through and, you know, hooking a few. You guys hooked a lot of fish this year.
It was fun, yeah. It was a fun year. There's also a lot of fish around.
There was, Yeah. So.
And a lot of that's thanks to you, too. I mean, we wouldn't have had that practice going into it. You know, our fishery wasn't as strong as yours when you're referring back to those, you know, 2007, 8, 9, 10, 11. We were kind of just on the upswing there, and you were really at the peak of the upswing with hand feeding and all that sort of thing. Like you said, it's still good. But, yeah, the fact that we got to practice with you guys up there, you know, over the last 10 years and being able to implement that here, it's made a huge difference for us.
Yeah. Yeah. And that part right there, it makes a difference when you get to so much practice and how you handle the situation is, you know, a lot of guys look at you that are commercial guys perhaps and like, what the hell's he doing? You know, let's follow him. Let's go to his numbers today. Let's follow the charter boats, you know, like let's try and ruin his party. Well, right. No, that's not how it is at all. It's just, you've been in so many situations, you're comfortable. And you can navigate through it, and you're at the end of the day, you're successful, you know. But at the same time, there's days we can't hook up, so it's still fishing. And with so much practice, you have no choice but to get better.
Right.
You have no choice.
Let's talk about drag for a second, because you mentioned that. How are you setting up your stand up reels? You know, when you're fighting out of the chair, what are you setting your reels at strike? What types of reels you're using, your line, like all that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
Kind of go through that.
It took us a while to learn how to do it. Especially, see, we're mandatory 100% circle hooks for catch and release fishery. And we even have to pinch the barb. So it took us a long time. We've experimented with different types of hooks. And for myself and our fleet, in the Bruce Brothers, the Mustad Perfect Demon Circle has been our go-to hook. We've had great success, as evidenced by our tagging studies and recaptures and whatnot. Like, the survival rate has been really good. But as far as the reels go, and there's still guys, there's some commercial guys trying to learn how to use the circle hook, and everybody does it differently. For myself and Troy, it's totally different.
It is. Yeah, explain that. That's actually really a good.
Yeah. No, he uses more drag than I do, and he's
on the hookup.
On a hookup, he uses more drag. Like I'll give you my example. Myself and Blair and Ben, two fingers. So we got the trackety out, and we've got the close bait. Even
when
on
you say just so trackety for people listening, it's like basically a shiner on a bobber, but it's a mackerel on a balloon that's just higher in the water column. We change it around depending on where we're marking fish, but it's just a high mackerel far away from the boat.
With no weight.
It's a high mackerel, live mackerel, far away from the boat, and 9 times out of 10, it's at the swivel, the balloon, just above the swivel. That's if you use a swivel. Some guys use straight fluorocarbon. We don't do that. But two fingers, and I can pull off the line with two fingers. Like, I'm not grasping the line and giving it a yank. You don't have to. My opinion behind the circle hook is you want them to swallow it. You want them to eat it. And then hopefully the fish turns away from the boat. And as he turns away from the boat, just slowly put your lever drag up. At the button on all my reels, whether stand up or chair, I have 45 pounds. So we'll slowly put the lever drag up to, and we use all pen, 100% pen. Pen reels, we've got all the new style pens, the 80s, 130s. We've got some 50s now. And the capability and smoothness of the drags in these reels, we're very confident in them. So I'll go up to, say, 30 pounds for the first 10 minutes. And for us, it's catch and release again. The idea is to get the fish back to the boat fast as possible. You know, don't break anything trying to get them in super green. But an hour, that's an average fight time, an hour. You know, you let them do that long run, and then you bump it up to the button, which is 45 pounds drag. And then bluefin tuna, for the most part at this point, are very predictable and very much the same. They do some long runs, and they're screaming line off, and then each run gets shorter. Then all of a sudden, they start doing the pinwheels. They could be high pinwheels, and then they'll go deep pinwheels. When you get them in the deep pinwheel, basically you're just walking them up the water column, and then all of a sudden you get your chance to leader the fish and put your swim hook in, your release hook, and the way you go. But the Mustad Perfect Demon circle hook, for me, is to let him eat it, swallow it, and as he turns away, it comes up, out, and hooks in the hinge. 9 times out of 10, it's in the hinge. The other time, I haven't seen a gut hook fish on my boat in years. Lip, I've seen it in the upper lip. I've seen one in the roof of the mouth. I'm not sure how that happened with the circle hook, but I've seen it in the roof of the mouth. But I talked to a guy there this summer. He's a commercial guy. I don't know what he's doing. It's not that he's doing anything wrong, but he's bad luck. He's something going on. He's tried the hooks and he's chafing them off and he thinks they're gut hooked. At the same time, they might not be. If it's in the hinge and the fish flips, changes his rotation of the circle to the other side, well, that line's got to rub across his upper teeth.
Right.
And that could break off. So know your leader length. Again, you got to learn your gear. Know your leader length. If your leader is 15 feet, for example, and you're missing 1 foot from the hook,
right?
Where you tied
exactly the width of the mouth, you know?
Exactly the width of the mouth.
Right.
So that was not gut hooked. I'm sorry. Yeah. That's your chafe bomb. We use chafe bombs. You guys, most times you don't use chafe gear.
Chafe bombs. Yeah. Chafe gear is, I mean, you guys call stuff like dinner, lunch here, that sort of thing.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. We, deckles, stickers and deckles.
They call stickers deckles.
Decals. Deckle decals.
Decals. I remember the first time Brian said that. I was like, yeah, we got to get some deckles on. He goes, what? It's deckles. You mean decals? I said, no, deckles. Yeah, I used to laugh about that one.
That's so funny.
Yeah, the lingo is, there's a huge difference in the lingo. Yeah.
I love it, though. Yeah. Every year I come back, I'm always talking. I'm like, yeah, put the trackety out, Tails. Like, you've been in Canada way too long.
yeah, for sure. Yeah. But no, it's fun. The drag is, we use very little drag on hookup. like I, you see on a lot of the TV shows, and you hear the click, 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 and then the rod's just bending. We don't get that. I don't get that on my boat. There's guys here that do that. Don't get me wrong. Like I'll go to Troy then. Troy uses more drag. Like he's got probably, I'm going to say 20 or 25 pounds of drag just on the initial strike, and his rod will bend. So his hook's not getting a chance to swallow. But he's had great success too. It's just different techniques, different captain, what you get comfortable with. I'm going to stick with what works for me. Obviously with Ben being my son, he's doing a lot of things the same way now, and it's working for him. He had a great year. It's his first year.
He had
year.
A killer year.
He had a great year, yeah. I think he made 12 trips and he had 10 fish or something like that.
That's sick.
Yeah. And see, up here, too, there's a loophole in the system that allows other captains to catch their fish. And it basically, you got to transfer your license and your boat to the other guy's name and then get a substitute operator. It's completely legal, and that's what Ben was doing. And so there's guys that just didn't want to. Like the price of fish was low this year. It was low for you guys. It was low for us, and it's all related due to COVID. At least that's what they tell us. And so some guys just didn't want to bother catching the fish, so they said, call up and say, hey, do you want to catch my fish? And so then he'd start the vessel and license transfer process. And so that's why he got to catch 10 fish. Now myself, I got 2, and Troy got 2, and that was it.
So you're allowed this year. So how many years in a row has it been 2 tags now that you've been given?
Well, everybody on Prince Edward Island is guaranteed their 1 tag if you should choose to use it. And then there's a lottery for tag number 2. And it all comes back to what quota you have. PEI's got 50% of the licenses in Canada, but we have approximately 30% of the quota, of Canadian quota. So that creates a problem right off the get-go. So everybody's guaranteed their 1 tag. You got to pick up your tag by a certain date, and you got to use it by a certain date. If you catch that tag in your name, there's a reallocation. It's a lottery, and it's a predetermined list. It's the same list from year to year, so it's fair for everybody. Everybody gets a chance at number 2. And I think this year, with so much effort in the early fishery in August, the average weight was a little smaller than years previous. And so more guys got their second tag because, again, it's based on your overall quota. So there is a component also of what you guys do also. It's called the Mexican quota. We're all part of the same United States, Canada, Mexico. Mexico chose not to use their quota, so they sell it basically for X per pound under the guise of science. And I think for us, those guys on the list this year to access a Mexican tag, it was around $950 just for the rights to choose a Mexican tag. Then you had to get your tag, which cost us $150. So it's a little more. I mean, some fish were only grossing $2,000 in a fish. So
that's a gamble.
It's a gamble.
It is a gamble.
There's a lot of guys didn't even utilize their Mexican tag. But there's guys up here this year that get over $10,000 easily for their fish. No question.
Wow.
There wasn't many. Market timing, basically no fish on the market. There's some early fish up here, very early fish, that got $45 a pound, $30 a pound. So
back to the boat.
Back to the boat.
Wow.
Yep.
That's unheard of down here.
Yeah. But that was a small handful of guys, don't get me wrong.
Right.
Then you get down to the normal average, which I'm going to say is, let's say it averaged $10.
Which is still way higher than here.
Yeah, your dollar's worth more, though.
True.
Yeah. Actually, I watched the market faithfully all year, and watching your guys' buyers, and it all goes to the same place in Japan. If they choose not to sell it domestically, it goes to Japan. And your guys' prices, I would say, on average, were maybe a touch higher.
Really?
With the yen per pound.
Right.
Yeah. And it's not always the case, and it's supply and demand. And if there's too many fish on the market, obviously it was sub 3,000 yen per fish, a lot. And then I think this year for us up here, we were happy to get anything over 3,000 yen a fish. So you know, it wasn't a banner year by no stretch of the imagination. There was more poor prices or average price than there was good stories. So it was a tough year. Now, lately, I'm going to say 2 weeks ago, there it was probably the best prices we've seen all year. And that was Canceltown, Nova Scotia fish. That's the Atlantic side of Nova Scotia as they're starting to migrate back out. And it's not that the fish were special and full of fat. It's just that there was no fish on the market.
Right.
And I believe some Boston fish hit the same market, done very well. And I believe some of the Carolina fish hit the same market, done. But now, just in the last immediate week, there's a lot of local Japanese fish hit the market. And to me, that's the big thing right there. If there's local Japanese caught fish, well, they're going to look after their own first. And probably rightfully so. Why not pay your own more than you would from an outside international fish? When there was no Japanese fish on the market, the North American fish, we'll call it, done much better, way better.
Yeah, it makes total sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
How about charters? Were you able to do any this year?
We had over 100 days booked just in the Bruce Brothers fleet this year. And I done one freebie and 3 other days. That's it with my boat. That's
crazy.
Troy didn't even bother getting his boat, putting the gear on the boat. He took his boat home. He sold his boat. Troy's got a new boat coming.
Yeah.
No, it was just nuts. I think Bradley, Tony's brother Bradley, he done maybe a handful of days. I think my first cousin Scott done a handful of days. I think Bruce and Ross done a couple days each. A few guys up the central part of the island done a couple days each. Like, no, just in all seriousness, our Canadian component, especially here, the way COVID was handled, it was called the Atlantic bubble, so that was Newfoundland, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, and PEI. The four provinces, anybody within them four provinces could travel for tourism related or see family or whatnot. That's the only chance that we had at a customer.
Wow.
But for us, our clientele base is mostly United States, especially in the Northeast, New York, Florida up, of course. And we get a lot of West Coast guys, and then we'll stretch out to as far as Australia, New Zealand, UK, whatnot. So we didn't see them guys this year. South Africa, we get South Africans. We'd never seen anybody, of course, with COVID. So it just killed us. And it killed tourism in general in all of Canada because, as you know, the border is still closed. And hopefully with the vaccine starting to roll out and hopefully in full-blown and successful by late spring, early summer, that the borders will be open again. We'll get back to normal and everybody stays healthy. So it's been a huge, huge game changer for us. Having said that, I had a fall off, we'll call it, and I got a lot of things done around home. And I got all next year's firewood out. I burned firewood. I got all next year's firewood. I'm usually scrambling after the boat comes home after Halloween and trying to get things done. And then weather sets in and you can't get all your firewood and chores.
You have plenty of bait.
Plenty of bait. Right?
Yeah. How's the trap building going? What's that process this winter?
I just started. We build wooden traps, of course, which is unlike your guys' area where it's all wire. But see, we're a cold water fishery, May and June, only 2 months. And so we find the wooden trap fishes better. Now, for you guys to use wooden traps, your guys, fishermen down there with the worms and the warm water, it just wouldn't last. But we find there is guys in the north of us in New Brunswick that do use wire traps. And I think it comes back to what you're comfortable with. But I started building my traps here. I rigged one trap, cut the twine and rigged one trap yesterday. That was the first one just to see if I liked how it looked and
knock the rust off a little bit.
Knock the rust off. And now I'll cut some webbing and stuff this week and before Christmas, get things ready for after Christmas. So, but no, we built last year. Actually, Bonnie and I and a bunch of friends went to Dominican Republic on vacation. And when we came back, we had to isolate for 2 weeks. So I got a lot done them 2 weeks. I got some of this year's chores done for lobster traps done last year because I done them all. So I have way too many traps built. So, you know, bought a snowmobile hoping for snow and it's green out. So I don't know. a lot of snowmobiles bought this year up here because nobody can go anywhere. But yeah. now we need snow.
I'm sure it'll come. That's the theme of this year, though. Just can't plan on anything.
Can't plan on anything.
One thing I want to touch on, I don't know how long we've been going, but
We got time.
Okay. One thing I want to talk about.
We can talk all day if you want. I know.
Which we just, you mentioned it, but we didn't go into, is some of the studies that you've been a part of with like releasing fish. And we kind of maybe shift back to like the gear thing and then go into how you, you know, you're releasing them and what you've done with scientists and all that.
Well,
it's to be interesting for people here that catch these fish. And, you know, a lot of people think that we're killing every single one that we're hooking.
Yeah. On our catch and release fishing thus far isn't as restrictive and as kind of dialed in as you guys have had it up there. So I think it's, like you said, it's kind of good to spawn this conversation and show what the stats really are a little bit. Right. You know?
Yeah. I think how this charter fishery was initiated was under a science clause that we were allowed to do a test fishery, and that was a tag and study. And I think that happened back in 2008. And there was bluefin tuna fishermen, licensed bluefin tuna fishermen in Prince Edward Island. We'd done our own study here in the island. Anybody could put their name in for a draw. So I think there was, I'm not sure how many captains there was, but there was 100 fish tagged. And they just used J-hooks. And these weren't experienced catch and release fishermen because there was no catch and release fishery. So they're just going out with traditional techniques and J-hooks and driving the drag up. And at that time, of them 100 fish, I think there was a mortality rate of just over 3.2% or 3.5%. And that's the science that we rode on. And these were actual tagged fish. So they could register the beacon and they knew if they were swimming away and they could follow them for a while and whatnot.
Wow.
And that was huge.
3%.
No, 3.something%.
Okay.
Little over 3%. So we fell under those guidelines. Like, even though it's catch and release, we're still under a scientific quota through ICAT, which is the international governing body for all of us. So we fell under the guidelines that we were killing 3.some%, and which was, they were very happy with. They found that to be very successful. So then we come in with the circle hooks, mandatory circle hooks, and then it took some practice that we already talked about and how to hook them and how to be successful and release the fish with the least amount of harm. And for us, that was an hour fight time. We found that if you were on a fish for 10 hours, or they found, science felt as though that if you're on a fish for 10 hours or 6 hours or whatnot, that the fish is really drained with energy and the lactic acid buildup was too much. And they didn't feel as though, even though they had no studies to prove otherwise, they didn't feel as though the chances of a healthy release were good. So they wanted us to do everything possible to release that fish within the 1 hour guideline, which we were. And then therefore we'll fall back to the 45 pounds of drag. And then we keep shoving the button on top of the button, past the button till we got the fish to the boat. A lot of times we got the fish to the boat. He was green as hell. And, you know, not every, we found the bigger fish, and I say bigger fish, 800 plus, to be lazy beside the boat. The most aggressive fish were the 600 to seven to the 800 pounders, the 700 pounders. They were green beside the boat. And then you get small fish that were, really quick, rapid tail beats and whatnot beside the boat, really hard to handle because they were unpredictable. It was this sub 500 fish. But we were still getting the healthy release and was successful. So we took it up another notch. We done a 2-year study with they weren't a pop-up satellite tag. And this is just what's done here too in Prince Edward Island, by the way. There's Nova Scotia did things a little differently. But here we done, it was an inserted tag and it let off a beacon and there was a science boat beside it. So we'd hook a fish.
Those are the acoustic ones, right? With
yeah,
the
we
stick
actually did
and
one
stuff.
Of those.
We did one with you.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the acoustic ones. So they let off a beacon. We call the science boat and say, "Hey, I'm on a fish. Do you want to tag this fish?" So they're like, Yeah. So they run over, pass us the tag as we're fighting the fish. And then we get it ready on a separate tag pole. And we'd insert the tag, and they'd tell us before we release the fish, just to, I'd be on the VHF, Blair be at the back and say, "Okay, we're going to release the fish now." So then they make sure their sonar's on, which is attached to the side of the boat and is submerged in the water down a little way. So the beacon would pick up the tuna, the sonar would pick up the tuna beacon. They'd follow that fish as long as they could. And very, very successful. We've done that over 2 years. I'm not sure how many fish. I think it was, I think the goal was 100 fish. I think we might have done more than 100 fish.
And you know, Ian, even just the past couple of years, like Ian had a day where he did some. I know we did some when we were up there within like the last 5 years. It was pretty much like spread pretty, it seemed evenly across the charter fleet the way.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. She did North Lake. She did Fisherman's Bank. She did Tignish. She did North Rustico. She was on Henry Island. She was up the shore off of Port Hood, Sight Point. She tried to really spread out the effort to make sure she covered her bases for the traditional hotspots where the fish were. Because there's different schools. Again, we'll go back to the river herring and the salmon. There's different schools go back to the same spots. I firmly believe that. So the fishery now, there's buoys. There's one off of Cape Breton. There's one off the Western PEI. There's one up off of Mascou. There's one off the Bay de Chaleur. There's some down along your coastline. And they, every time a tuna swims by that, this buoy, it picks up the beacon. And we've had some, and they have to go physically pick up the buoy, pull the data from the buoy before they can read how much info that, how many fish went by and whatnot. Yep. And they do it consistently each year at the same time of the year. So they, to create their pattern.
Interesting. And
we've done that study. And she went 100% success. 100%.
So every single fish?
Every buoy. Fish re-signaled their beacon on a buoy. Every fish.
Wow. And just off the top of your head, how many of those that you released that you may have thought of, wow, this thing's exhausted, or you know, maybe this one won't swim away? Like, was there any that were questionable? Or they all?
I think my own boat, I think I'd done 5 or 6 tags with her. They were all excellent. We actually done one on the TV show with Big Water Adventures and Mark Davis. We done one on the show. Like, that's how confident we are in this. Like, we have zero issue with that fish. Zero. I've had...
The back and forth. Yep. You just broke up for a sec.
We're good, yeah. Yep.
Yep. Right. Cool.
So, yeah, no, get back to the fish. I've had personally had some of my fish beacon down off Florida. So... submit a signal and she pulls the data and they got to notify her and then she notifies us and now it's been hugely successful and we get the same thing, Taylor. We get guys saying, oh, you're killing the fish. We get guys saying they land one of the commercial fish and it's skinny. Oh, that's because you guys are hooking, releasing them and they won't feed again for another year. And like, come on, guys, they just migrated back into the Gulf of Mexico. They just migrated back up past PEI, probably up to the Bay de Chaleur off the Mascou Island, New Brunswick, feeding on herring, feeding on mackerel the whole way. They don't not eat.
Right.
They got to eat. They got to eat to survive. So for us, we used to be a competitive. The year, Brian, that you guys were here, I think in 2010, that was an opening of the competitive fishery.
Yeah.
That was the last time it was competitive. That was the very, very last time it was competitive. We have not had a competitive fishery ever since. It's gone to the one tag per license holder lottery for tag two. There's just too many license holders, active license holders, for the amount of quota we have. So that's a huge loss of income. So what do we do? Okay, guys, this is a huge deal. We're seeing all this hand feeding going on. Like, we can market this. We can create a sport fishery back like when our father's done. The bluefin fishery here in Prince Edward Island started back in the day by the sport fish captains. That's how they got the tuna fishery developed and whatnot. And of course, it was different back then. They were trolling with daisy chains and single mackerel. But we're not reinventing the wheel. If anything, it's probably better. It's healthier for the stock of fish because we're releasing them. It's been successful. We've proven that time again. Back in the day, they used to troll with sport fishery. You take the fish in, hang it, get the pictures, and then tow it back to sea and dump it because there was no market. They didn't know what to do with them.
Horse mackerel.
It's come a long way. It certainly
has.
You're always going to have your critics. And at the end of the day, we believe what we're doing is not helping or not hurting the fishery. I mean, it's helping the economy. It's keeping everything robust around here. And we made a lot of great friendships around the world. And the fishery, the bluefin tuna fishery, with social media and ease of access to information, there's fish everywhere.
Everywhere.
There can be days in any given season where we're catching them as far north as the Gaspé, Quebec, and they're catching them down off Chatham. They're catching them in the UK, and there's fish everywhere. There's people catching fish in places that never caught fish before. Is that a stock that is in trouble? I don't think so.
I couldn't agree more. And especially if we kind of take a page out of the book from up there and releasing and stuff over the last 10 years and really kind of implement that a little bit better, even just a small percentage point better here, right. it's just gonna sustain it even more.
Yeah. You know? No, I think the stock's healthy and what we're doing is working. And we'll look at that fish that I think is the Large Pelagic Center just released info on, was tagged. I forget the exact numbers now. I think it was 7 years ago or something like that, or 10 years ago. And it was just caught off of Spain. It grew to over 1,000 pounds in that time. And he survived, you know, and he's actually survived a long time feeding all them years to be recaptured just now. We've tagged fish. Troy has tagged a fish off of Surrey in 2011. It was caught the following year off of Spain on a longline vessel. So, you know, is there mixing of the stock? The sign said, oh, no, there's no, that's the Western Atlantic and Eastern Atlantic stock. Bullshit. It's a big
thing. We got one with an acoustic tag on it that they pulled. They went back and pulled the data from the buoy, like you mentioned. This was Claire's first time ever in PEI, my wife's first time in PEI. We harvested a fish like the first day with Troy.
Yeah.
And the tag data that came back on that fish, it was tagged at Fisherman's Bank initially, I believe, by a boat out of Nova Scotia, went down through the Northeast Canyons, down the continental shelf south, and then went out to Bermuda off of Florida, and then the track was all the way back and was you know, harvested and recaptured by us in the exact same spot.
Yeah, yeah. So they're amazing animals. They really are. And they're so resilient. It's. I don't think a lot of people understand how strong they are, actually are. Like, they're capable.
Yeah. I have a story of how strong they are.
Where's this one going?
In reference to that day I was just talking about, the day we got a, or was it? No, I think this was the next day. Same trip, next day. We were fighting a fish with Pritch's dad in the chair on Troy's boat. And this guy's like 6'4". What would you say? Like close to 300 pounds? 275 anyway? I mean, you met him.
Yeah, yeah.
Big dude. So he's in the chair. He's, you know, we're on a fish for about half hour, 45 minutes. It's probably 2 to 3s. It was like northwest, like 10 to 15 on Fisherman's Bank. It was like perfect tuna weather. That bite that day was absolutely savage. But anyway, Pritch's dad is in the chair. We get the fish like pinwheeling deep, you know, 50, 75 feet away, and we snap the base plate on the chair with like 60 pounds of drag, with Pritch's dad, 300 pounds, 6'4" dude, stood up. He stood up in the chair, and the pedestal, like the plate on the bottom where it connects to the pedestal on the chair, snaps forward, and he's big enough and smart enough to put his feet on deck. So he has the chair on like a stand-up harness.
Oh,
at this point, chair is completely detached.
What an absolute beast.
Dude, chair is completely detached from the boat. You know, he backs the drag off. It was short-lived, like fighting the chair, fighting the fish with a fighting chair harness.
Right.
We get it into the holder. We finish it off. And then we actually finish the day going stern to stern with Craig, past our broken chair to him, his good chair to us, so we could continue releasing fish, you know, our next fish for the day. So we passed chairs in, you know, three footers after battling one, after snapping it, and then we went and, you know, limited out, and we're home by lunch. But that's how strong they are. They can snap fighting chairs in half.
Yeah.
I don't think the 300-pound human helped, but.
We've broken a lot of rods. We've broken chairs, and it's crazy. Well, we use so much pressure, right? Yeah. And, you know, guys say, oh, what do you got on there for top shot? And we'll say, oh, we got, you know, 150 Mackay, or he goes, you know, 200 diamond line, Moy Moy diamond line, and you're running 60 pounds of drag. Yeah, it'll handle it. And then we break a chair.
What's the most drag you've seen put on a fish?
A little over 70 pounds. That's just on the reel. And then we'll put our hands on the line. So
right.
we've had fish, we just couldn't get them up. So you're maxed out, you're full sunset on drag, and then you'll start hand bombing them, two hands, one over the other, and just trying to pull the fish up. And you could tell with the pinwheel, the head down on one side of the turn, the head's down, and then the head's up, and that's when you try and get a little extra. Then when he's putting his head down, you're just trying to hold it. But I wouldn't be scared to say that we've put probably 100 pounds of drag on fish with their hands and whatnot. Yep. over and above. Yeah, no question.
Yeah.
I know I've fought one in full drag in the chair. I know Dave Good fought one stand up.
On full drag.
On full drag.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've done one stand up on full drag, 65 pounds. I couldn't walk right for the next couple of days. But.
What's the trick with stand up fishing that you see? Like, what are the mistakes?
Mistakes?
And advantages, like,
I think one of the biggest mistakes is too much drag too quick.
Yes.
That's one of the biggest things, because if you enter into a battle with a bluefin and you think you're going to land him in 30 minutes and it happens to be a 500-plus-pound fish and you go full drag on him, you, for lack of a better word, you're screwed. You're going to hurt. Your quads are going to feel like they're flattened out and you're not going to be able to walk, and you're just going to get a fish in a deep. They like that 50 to 75 feet for us when they're getting them pinwheels down there. It's hard to get them up then. That's one of the big mistakes in stand-up that I see, is to come in all aggressive and say, oh, yeah, I fought yellowfin and I've done this. And then they get in there and they just do too much too quick. And we've had guys say, get me the hell out of this. They just couldn't do nothing with it. But
I did that once. I said, get me the hell out of this. It sucks.
Yeah. But not sitting back, being comfortable in your harness properly too, and you're too straight. That's a mind over matter comfort level thing too. This, if that rod breaks or that line breaks, you're going flying backwards. So a lot of times we'll reassure the angler that, you know, Blair's with me, he'll just spot him. He'll just kind of stand behind him and have a shoulder right in case he falls backwards. Being too straight is a bad move on stand-up.
Stand-up.
Yeah, being too straight is a bad move on stand-up. That's one of the killers right off the get-go, and too much drag too quick. So it's a process, and for us, we understand it. You let the fish make a few runs, each run gets shorter, and then he does his high pinwheels, and he goes into deep pinwheels, and you get the fish, but... we've had guys, like I said, they've been with us year after year, and they've tried it. They'll come up and they'll say, oh, I'm going full bar, full sunset right off within 15 minutes. And no,
yeah, no,
not smart. And then they got to back it off, and then the fight starts all over again. So end up being longer on the fish in all essence, because it takes longer.
One big thing that I've, for stand up chair and chair is, always go a little tighter with your harness than you think, because everything always, especially with big bluefins, you know, once you get them in those deep pinwheels, and that's when you start feeling the pressure. It's not those big surface runs and stuff with, you know, 20, 30 pounds of drag if you're smart and just clearing the top shot. It's when they're straight up and down is when you're going to want to wish you had your harness or whatever a little bit tighter, because you lose angle. All that pressure, everything's stretching out. Even if you lose 5 degrees at like where you want to be to keep that bend in the rod and keep pressure on their head, you won't have enough if you've been on them for 45 minutes to an hour and you start loosening everything up, you know?
Exactly. It just stretches out and then you start to lose it. Yeah, for sure. And we've had to, during mid-flight, readjust. Happens all the time.
Yep. Yeah, some of the new stuff.
Yeah,
the harnesses you guys use, like the Black Magic harness, the Melton Bucket. Like, it's pretty easy to cinch up mid fight too, as long as you have pressure against the rod. You know,
that's right. Yeah, that's right. We've used different stand up harnesses. We find the Black Magic works really, really good. It's probably our go to. Next to that would be the Dennis Braid Power Play belt, the black and red belt. We were breaking the pads. The braid, the normal blue and white belt, we were snapping
power play or something.
Yeah, we were snapping them in half with the pressure we were applying with the drag. So
where the butt meets the plate,
we were snapping them right in half. There. Yeah, near denutted a guy from Texas one day. He never fought a fish after that again. So
I bet he didn't do a lot of things after that again.
except thanked everyone and prayed. Oh my god.
Yeah. And he was a big boy, you know. It was funny. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Fucked up.
Well, we've been going for over an hour and a half. This has been awesome. We have a lot of good stories, a lot of good stuff.
I think we need to do this again.
Definitely.
Definitely.
I think we got to figure out our kind of next step for quote unquote season two after we get through the holidays is try to figure out a few more mics and be able to get, like, you know, Troy, you, Ben, Blair, like do kind of a larger group and just tell stories, you know. I think it would be an absolute blast.
Blair will have some stories.
We could do one.
I think we need to do it at night too.
Yeah.
A little bit of whiskey and a little
bit of
rum.
A few cocktails definitely would help.
Yeah.
We just have so many. Like, this was so awesome, man. First of all, thank you. But it's hard to fit in every single fish story. There's so many. Yeah.
No, it's terrific. It's great to connect with you guys. It's been a long time. And thanks for having me. It's been A1.
How does everyone, if people want to book a charter with you guys, website, what's the social and all that sort of thing?
Our website is www.peibluefintunacharters.com. And of course, you can phone us at 909-8033. And you can phone Troy at 902-969-2408. And we've got a lot of reservations on the books right now for 2021. Hopefully there's no COVID. But we're looking forward to it and getting back into the grind.
Oh, we can't wait. We're already chomping at the bit.
And you're on Instagram and Facebook and stuff too?
We are on Instagram and Facebook, just under Bruce Bro, B-R-O-S dot, Bruce Bro. Yep. Yeah, Bruce Bro Charters. Okay. Yeah. So
they're easy to find. A lot of good content, a lot of cool hand feeding videos and stuff on there over the years for sure. So if you haven't checked them out, make sure you check them out.
All right. It's been a pleasure, guys. Thanks very much.
All right, man. All right. We'll see you later. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
See ya.
Take care.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of the Sea Bros Fishing Podcast. We want to take a moment to again thank our sponsors, Mass Bay Guides, LT Marine Products, and Deep Apparel. If you guys haven't checked them out on social media already, please make sure you do so. See new products, fishing reports, and what everyone has going on into next season. For the latest content, podcast info, fishing reports, general updates, please make sure that you check us out and follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Sea Bros Fishing, Mass Bay Guides, or our personal accounts, MBG Taylor and MBG Brian. If you have ideas for podcast topics, podcast guests, you know, where they're on there all the time, very responsive, please don't hesitate to reach out and shoot the breeze with us if you want to talk fishing or if you want to just brainstorm on the podcast. Also, if you are interested in getting some Sea Bros swag, maybe one of our Tuna Mark patch hats that seem to be pretty popular. We came out with buffs this year that have like a wolf pack on them that are pretty cool, like a wolf pack of tuna or whatever fish species that you like to mark on your fish finder. Those are also available at the Sea Bros website. So just visit seabrosfishing.com. Right there on the front page, you can scroll through the gallery of products that we offer so far. That's all we have for you guys today. Thanks for listening and stay tight.